From NHPR, I'm Peter Biello, and this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. The United States has fought pandemics before. It's wrestled with civil rights issues and navigated the noise of a contested presidential election. But in 2020, all those things happened all at once, and it added up to a year unlike any other. Today on the Roundup, we're looking back at the biggest stories of 2020 and taking stock of how we as a news organization had to adapt. And we want to hear your thoughts on the biggest stories of 2020. Coronavirus, Black Lives Matter, the beginning of the end of the Trump presidency. Of course, these are huge stories, but there are elements of those stories that really might have meant a lot to you. We want to know what those are. Call us now, 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You could also email us. Our address is exchange@nhpr.org. And joining me now is Corey Princell, managing editor of NHPR. Hey, Corey.
Hey, Peter.
I want to spend some time talking to you a little bit about how NHPR adapted to this crazy year. Let me ask you first, how did NHPR's newsroom pivot from having almost an entire staff in the office to having almost everyone working remotely?
Yeah, it happened so suddenly. I'm sure you remember. People like you and Rick had to keep coming into the office, but those of us who had the ability to work from home, we tried to find a way to do that just like overnight one day in March, I remember. The pivot in terms of staying in touch with each other was probably the easiest part. We had a lot of systems that made it easy for us to communicate, you know, on Slack and some of our ways of filing stories we could do remotely. I think the trickiest part was finding people to talk to when we were all sitting in our homes. And then getting good sound quality for our stories. So that's where a lot of our creativity came in. I think, you know, reporters traditionally, they get voices and stories by going, you know, walking around streets and going into businesses and being invited to people's homes and attending meetings. And we couldn't do any of that. So one of the best things we did was start an audience survey. We started that on March 2nd. And we've had, you know, we've had thousands of responses since then. But in the early days, it just really helped us get a sense of what people were experiencing when we couldn't see people face to face anymore.
Right, that has been a challenge.
In our stories.
Yeah, I will say I have enjoyed the normalization of Zoom conversations. The sound quality is much better than phone.
Yeah, no, it's true. And I think even phone tape, like we had so much phone tape in our stories at the beginning. And it almost captured that feeling of distance we all suddenly had with each other.
Yeah, exactly. You know, there has been a lot of bad news this year, much of it about the coronavirus pandemic, but of course, other subjects as well. How have you, as managing editor, tried to balance these hard-hitting news stories, stories with death and anger and lots of negative emotions, not always fun to read, with more uplifting stories?
I think it's a good question. I think, you know, there were days when that was hard, but I think we found a lot of light in the darkness just by hearing how people were adapting, you know, the creativity that we experienced in the newsroom. People had in so many parts of people's lives, the ways that people adapted, the ways they worked to help each other led to a lot of really lovely stories. Like I'm thinking about one that Daniela Ali did about how health workers in Nashua realized that, you know, a lot of people weren't coming in to be tested because all the testing sites required cars. And so they put up a new testing site in a church in Nashua where people could walk to it. They knew there'd be Spanish spoken. So like those kinds of responses, you know, meeting people where they are, I think that led to some really lovely stories. I mean, I'm even thinking about Peter, the series that we worked on in the spring, looking at how people impacted by trauma were dealing with the pandemic. And each one of those stories had these moments of light, you know, the power of yoga, of food, of you know, looking out for each other. I think that I heard just a lot of uplifting ideas and stories just in focusing on that.
Well, listeners, good time for you to chime in with the uplifting story of 2020 that still resonates with you. Let us know what that story is. Our number is 1-800-892-6477. You can also email exchange@nhpr.org. A few other things to note about NHPR service this year, Corey. In April, NHPR created Cajay de Nuevo, New Hampshire. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, which offers a Spanish language audio update. What's the goal of this service and how's it been going so far?
Oh, it's, yeah, it's really, it's something that's, it's very exciting. I checked in with the host of that show, which is Daniela Ali. They have 230 followers right now. It's a daily broadcast on WhatsApp in Spanish. And the goal is to deliver news to New Hampshire's Spanish-speaking community at a time when, when we really need clear news and information. You know, stories about COVID testing and the vaccine and, you know, what businesses are open and school closures. So that's how it started. But the producer, Maria Aguirre and Daniela, have plans to expand in the new year, doing more Spanish-first interviews, maybe a couple a month about relevant news topics. What they want to do is address the vital information gap, but also work on ways of telling stories about and for this community. They're representative of the, you know, the breadth of experience and in the Spanish-speaking community here in New Hampshire.
And has NHPR or maybe Daniela Ali specifically received any feedback from people who've been listening and who find this really valuable?
I think definitely. I think it's definitely growing. It's filling a need, and it's just a really exciting area of growth for us.
And speaking of areas of growth, NHPR launched By Degrees this year to more intensely and specifically cover climate change. What's the goal of this initiative?
Yeah, this is another exciting project that I've been pretty closely involved with Annie Ropeek on, our energy and environment reporter. The goal of this project is somewhat simple. We want to do more stories about climate change. And climate change has always been, it's a massive, complicated, important topic, but it's because of that, maybe it's easy to sort of set it aside and focus on other things. So we launched this as a way of raising the visibility of our climate change reporting, doing it more frequently, organizing it. We've got a landing page for the project where you can go and find all of our stories we've done in the past and currently about things like energy and transportation and waste, health, all these things relate to climate change. And we launched the project with a kind of editorial focus that gives it, I think, a different sound than maybe other climate change reporting that you hear. We've got this framework that Annie and I talk about frequently where we want to do stories about how people are impacted by climate change. We want to take into account racial, economic inequities when we're thinking about that. We want to look at the activities and practices that cause climate change and, pay attention to power structures, economic systems, that cause global emissions. And we want to report on the strategies that are being developed to respond to climate change. And a lot of those strategies are really being challenged right now, as the economies economies in the state deal with coronavirus. So it's been a really rewarding project. And we've got a lot of, we've also got a lot of ideas and exciting plans for it.
More ideas than I believe you might have time to cover, I imagine.
That's the problem. That's always the problem.
It's always the problem, drinking from a fire hose kind of situation here. Yeah. Well, I mean, that's been the story all year, right? So much news to cover, especially when it comes to coronavirus, updates constantly. How do you stay up to date on all the latest news, especially as it seems to be changing so rapidly and there's so much of it going on?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's just been a whole newsroom endeavor, really, and at times almost feels like a whole station endeavor. I was remembering, one of the first Slack channels we set up in this was like a coronavirus ideas channel because everybody was experiencing it and everybody had ideas. But we had almost every newsroom, every reporter in the newsroom took coronavirus as part of their beat, and it was a team effort. Like I can remember in the early days, if you remember this, Peter, the governor did 3 press conferences a week.
Mm-hmm.
One of those, we had to have a host. We had, someone updating the blog. We had someone making sure the news got on the radio. We had somebody making sure we were updating our FAQs and other web posts. I mean, it took a whole bunch of people just to get the news out. But we really devoted a lot of time and people to that effort.
And what sort of, go ahead.
We still do.
I was going to ask, what kind of engagement and feedback have you received from our listeners this year? Is there a way to categorize the types of comments we've gotten? Is there an overarching theme?
Yeah, well, this year's been a big change for us. I mean, we always get a lot of, we always get a lot of feedback, to our journalism. But this year, we really made some big steps towards increasing our community engagement. That survey that I mentioned that we launched in early March, we've had that going this whole time. We've got our 5th version of it up right now, and we've had thousands of people fill it out. And that's just been really exciting for me. We've hired our first ever permanent community engagement producer. That's Zoe Knox. And it's just giving us, we're finding more ways to connect with our audience. And we're really finding that that's shaping our stories. I think a lot of the questions that people are writing in with, you know, you and Laura ask people on the exchange, like we're hearing what people want to know, we're hearing what people experience, and it's just leading to richer stories.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I will say firsthand, I've contacted people who have responded to surveys, and they've helped in my reporting personally, and I know colleagues in the newsroom have also benefited from folks taking the initiative and responding to those surveys. Listeners, if you're interested in filling out that survey, by the way, nhpr.org/surveys. So, Corey, looking back on the year, what themes have emerged as especially prevalent?
It's interesting. I think one thing that I've been thinking about a lot this year is I feel like this was a year when a lot of people saw things maybe that they hadn't seen before. When you think about all that we've been through, I think the coronavirus exposed a lot of inequities in terms of, you know, people who are able to sort of glide through it without a lot of impact and other people who lost their jobs, had no childcare, you know, the inequities in the healthcare system that led to racial and ethnic, you know, huge disparities in terms of people dying and getting sick. I think, you know, racism became a focus. And I think that, you know, people who had maybe thought about it but never demonstrated, white people who had never demonstrated before, came out on the streets. And I mean, there was just a new focus on things that had long existed. I think even climate change got more attention this year. So, and you know, and I think the other sort of theme here is that when people were stuck at home, you know, spending a lot more time with their families in their backyards, I think people saw things there that they maybe hadn't seen before. And felt maybe more gratitude. We heard a lot about that in our engagement, and you know, when we had, we've had that, heard that in our talk shows. I think people saw good things and came to cherish things in their lives that maybe they hadn't appreciated before.
So going forward, I mean, the popular thing to say now is what happens in 2020 does not stay in 2020, right? We're going to be dealing with the lingering effects of this year next year. What does that mean in terms of news coverage for NHPR? What is the coverage going to look like?
Well, we're definitely going to look at the impacts, you know, how this is going to impact town budgets, how this is going to impact students, and, you know, and student achievement and outcome in schools. I mean, there are going to be long-term impacts that we'll be keeping an eye on. I think a lot of the techniques that we developed in journalism will also really help us in this next year. All of our engagement will continue, and that'll still, you know, provide a lot of richness for our stories.
NHPR's managing editor, Corey Princell, thank you very much for chatting with me this morning. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Peter.
We want to turn now to take a look at some of the biggest business stories of the year. Let's talk with Jeff Feingold, editor of New Hampshire Business Review. Hey, Jeff, thank you very much for taking some time.
Thanks for inviting me, Peter. It's great to be here.
So,
virtually be here.
Well, yes, virtually, of course, keeping safe here. What industries were hardest hit by the coronavirus pandemic this year? Which industries took the biggest hit?
Well, yeah, without a doubt. I mean, that's like a no-brainer. Absolutely the hospitality industry, which includes restaurants and hotels and, you know, tourism in general. Was just completely slammed by the virus. You know, it's interesting because when you think about it, so many other sectors seem to be doing pretty well, but relatively well. They were able to adapt. But when it came to hotels or restaurants adapting, it basically what they said was, you know, you can only do 50% or even some cases 25% of your business to stay open or to be open. And that's pretty much unsustainable. And we've seen that, unfortunately, in closings of several restaurants all around the state. You know, at the Business Review, we're trying to keep track of that, and it's hard to. It's hard to find out, but you could just drive down a main street in any big city or even some towns, and you'll see shuttered restaurants. And it's been a very brutal year for that sector.
And some folks have said, well, what about the PPP? What about, you know, interest-free loans that the government has tried to offer these places to stay afloat? From what you're saying, it seems like they have maybe lessened the pain, but not Yes. eliminated it completely, and some places still have closed.
That's exactly right. And, you know, the Paycheck Protection Program was very helpful. Unfortunately, you know, it was really just a down payment on assistance. And, you know, we know what's going on in Washington now where they're trying to put together another package. But for a lot of businesses, the support was really needed, the reinforced support was needed in the summertime. And, you know, whatever, we don't have to get into discussions about, you know, objectives in Washington, but it was really, it's really pretty disheartening to see that it's taken so long to actually come up with another infusion of support for businesses that have been struggling. And well, the same is true of unemployment insurance as well, the unemployment benefits.
Yeah, let's dive into that in a moment. I just want to put a plug to our listeners to tell us what business story meant the most to you this year. What do you think NHBR or NHPR did a good job covering? Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477 or email exchange at nhpr.org. So, yeah, Jeff, what about that unemployment situation? How would you describe over the course of 2020 the government's response to the greater demand for unemployment insurance?
Well, you know, I have to say, first of all, you know, I mean, when this whole thing started in March, you know, the New Hampshire's unemployment rate in April, I believe it was April, was 17%. 17% of the workforce was unemployed. And since then, we've gone down to about 3.8%, which is historically pretty high for New Hampshire lately, but it's remarkable. But the problem is, like I said, a lot of the people in the sectors I was talking about, hospitality, restaurants, retail, you know, a lot of those people are still struggling mightily and were collecting benefits as early as March, and they're running out. They're running out, and you know, it's a similar situation to the PPP. It's through no fault of their own they've lost their jobs, and they've been trying to survive on unemployment insurance, and unemployment benefits have not been the most robust in New Hampshire. Fortunately, there was an added benefits from the federal government for $600 a week. Then it became $300. But now that's expiring at the end of this month, end of the year. And we don't know what kind of it sounds like there'll be a $300 a week added benefit again. But there has to be an extension for people that they can continue to get benefits beyond the expiration of their benefits, which are running out very shortly.
Right, it's not the only thing under negotiation right now in the Congress. Jeff, I want to ask you about inequities that the pandemic has exposed, right? Economic disparities that exist in New Hampshire. How would you describe those disparities? Who's most affected?
You know, New Hampshire's economy. We've talked about this many times. As I've been on the exchange before, and we've written articles about this in the paper over many years. There's really like two economies in New Hampshire. There's Southern New Hampshire and Northern New Hampshire. And I think that you can really see that this has been exacerbated. This disparity between geographic disparity has been really, it's been highlighted by this pandemic. Because many of the successful businesses, like manufacturers, tech industries, they've adapted really very well. And in many cases, manufacturers were considered essential businesses, and they never closed. Many manufacturers we've talked to are doing really, really well. You could look at New Hampshire state business tax revenues. They're up by about 25% from expectations, and that's because businesses are making profits. But so many of those businesses, the vast majority, are concentrated in the southern part of the state. There aren't many businesses like that in the northern part of the state. And that's where there's the most, they're completely reliant in many cases on the tourism industry. And tourism has taken a hit, as we all know, because people, first of all, weren't able to go to hotels for a while. Second of all, there are still people who don't want to travel. And third, these hotels have limited capacity in most cases for safety reasons, for safety and health reasons. So the lack of opportunity is even more stark now that we see how the pandemic has affected the state differently in different areas.
So again, it seems like it comes down to the hospitality industry, Jeff.
Yes, it really is. I mean, New Hampshire is not, it's not a, we're not a tourism-based economy, but tourism is an essential sector for the state in terms of employment. You know, in terms of the quality of the jobs, the pay that you get from working in like manufacturing and other kinds of businesses, healthcare, those are, you know, those are much more dynamic and much more have much more of an impact in general on the economy. But for employment, for just in terms of the mass number of people employed in tourism related businesses, you know, that's a lot of people, and they've been affected by this more than people in other businesses. So look, I'm a perfect example. In my business, it wasn't very hard to adapt to working at home. You know, we just did it. You know, we have the technology, we can do the technology, just like you guys. You've been, many of you people are working at home.
Many of us,
and,
yes.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, if you work in a restaurant or a retail or a hotel, yeah, no, you have to go to work. And it's not, and if the work's not open or is not available, what do you do? You know, that's really one of the things, one of the unfortunate stark realities that have emerged from this pandemic.
Yeah, well, let's talk a little bit about the workforce, because even before the pandemic, New Hampshire was facing a workforce shortage. Seems like it might have gotten a bit worse during the pandemic. What do you say, Jeff?
Yeah, that's really one of the more interesting things that's occurred. You know, you'd think that with this historically high unemployment rate, that there'd be lots of people clamoring for these jobs that are open. There are openings, many of them in the tech and manufacturing fields, but for some reason, people aren't going for those jobs who are unemployed. In many cases, they don't have the skills, but in other cases, it appears that there are people who are just not being motivated enough to go to work right now because of fears surrounding the virus. So it's a double-edged thing. It's like these employers need employees. There should be a bigger source of employees because there's more higher unemployment, but they still haven't been able to find them. And it's an odd situation that's happening.
Mm-hmm. So going forward in 2021, what's the focus of your reporting going to be?
Well, ongoing coverage of what's going on in how New Hampshire's economy and businesses are reacting and responding to COVID, because it certainly is not going to go away on New Year's Day, and we'll be seeing more about how they respond, how they, to use the word of 2020, pivot and make changes, and in particular we'll be looking at this hospitality industry, which is really important, and you know, how they're surviving, how they're trying to survive. There, you know, there's talk of more assistance coming from Washington specifically for restaurants. That's probably be very welcome, but you know, who knows when that'll happen. But just the idea of looking at how New Hampshire's economy, which really, considering how we were just thrown for such a loop in the spring when the pandemic first hit, that it really has adapted on the whole pretty well. And we'll keep an eye on that, because that's, you know, that's how we're all getting jobs and eating. So
right.
That's really what we'll be doing.
Well, Jeff Feingold, editor of New Hampshire Business Review, thanks for being on the program today.
It was great. Take care and have a great holiday.
You too. Thanks. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on the Exchange on NHPR. We're taking a look back at the year 2020. An incredible year. We're taking stock of it. It was a presidential election year. We saw record voter turnout. Still to come, NHPR's Casey McDermott has been following every twist and turn of how New Hampshire's elections were conducted. Was there an election story that made a difference to you? What element of voting in this year's election will you remember the most? Give us a call. Our number is 1-800-892-6477. You can also email exchange@nhpr.org. I'm Peter Biello. More after a break. Monday on The Exchange, we're taking a moment to reflect on the year and a special show with Laura Kanoy and Rick Ganley, host of Morning Edition. We'll check back in with a few people we heard from during the year, and we also want to hear from you. Tell us about a moment in 2020 that had an impact on you, an act of kindness, a story of resilience, a conversation you had, maybe an action you took. That's on Monday on The Exchange. Tune in for that live at 9 on Monday. Today, we're taking a moment to reflect on the top stories of 2020. And in this part of the program, we want to reflect on the election. For a look back at the election and how the pandemic left its mark on it, we turn to NHPR's Casey McDermott. She covered the mechanics of voting in the 2020 primary and presidential elections. Casey, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Peter.
And listeners, if you've got a question about how voting went this year, if you'd like to highlight a particular story about voting in the 2020 election, give us a call now. Our number is 1-800-892-6477. You can also email exchange at nhpr.org. Casey, let's start back at the beginning of the year, before the coronavirus pandemic, when the big story of the year was the 2020 presidential election and the primary. So what was it like to cover the primary this year?
Well, I think it's fair to say it was quite a roller coaster and a little bit challenging at times, just given the sheer size of the field that we saw this year. There were so many candidates running. And I think at NHPR, one of the things that I, I'm proud of in our coverage and was proud to be a part of was the effort that we took to really take a step back and to focus at times less on the horse race to the extent possible and more on, first and foremost, the issues that people were concerned about. We heard Corey, one of our editors, talking earlier about our audience engagement work. We carried that through to the primary as well. We did a survey for that. We did a lot of audience engagement seeking to better understand how we as a newsroom could make our primary coverage reflective of the actual questions and concerns that, people in New Hampshire and voters in New Hampshire had as they were wading through that big field of candidates. And one of the questions that we actually got a lot of was, why is New Hampshire first? Why does it matter that we're first? Why are we, why is the New Hampshire primary so, so important and so in the limelight? So that dovetailed really well into our podcast, Stranglehold, which focused on kind of the institutions and individuals and kind of, powerful people around protecting New Hampshire's primary. That was really a team effort along with or really led by my colleagues, Lauren Chulgin, Jack Rodolico, Jason Moon, Josh Rogers. A whole list of people were involved in that. And that was something that I think really stands out in terms of how we tried to approach the coverage of the primary this year.
And the question of, should New Hampshire be the first presidential primary comes up seemingly every time there is a presidential primary here in New Hampshire. It seemed to have more of a fever pitch this year. I don't know if that's just my subjective interpretation, but what was your sense of the primary after the result? Because, I mean, the person who eventually won the presidency, President-elect Joe Biden, left New Hampshire before the primary was over, and now he's president-elect.
Right. Well, I mean, I can tell you that, there's a very narrow window of time. It feels so long ago now between when the primary ended and, the next big story arrived, which was COVID. But I can tell you that in that window, that question was very much on our minds, given what you mentioned. Now president-elect Joe Biden left the state before the election was called in February in New Hampshire, had a pretty dismal showing here, had a pretty dismal showing in Iowa, but then went on once he, moved on to other states, and particularly states that are more diverse than Iowa and New Hampshire, appealed to kind of a wider population of people. He did much better than he did here in New Hampshire. And I think in the long run, we are going to see a revival of the conversation about New Hampshire's role and Iowa's role. I think in some respects, I'm going to put my pundit hat on here for a minute, so forgive me. Iowa's caucus, as we all recall, was pretty messy. And there were a lot of problems in terms of how that was run. So I think in some respects that may have helped New Hampshire because the primary went really smoothly by comparison from an election administration standpoint. Many people in politics here were very quick to point that out. And I think we'll continue to emphasize that in the ongoing conversations around the future of the New Hampshire primary. But these are all conversations that take place really, in the years to come. So I think there's certainly no I don't anticipate that this conversation will go away anytime soon, but obviously there are a lot more pressing issues in front of us right now.
Among those, of course, the coronavirus pandemic hit in March. Since then, Casey, how have you gone about covering COVID data in New Hampshire? Because state government's been collecting quite a bit of it.
Yeah. Well, you know, again, we can time travel back to the very, very beginning of this in early March. New Hampshire identified or publicly announced its first case of COVID-19 on March 2nd. And at first, and really to this day, as journalists and as members of the public, we're kind of at the mercy of what information is made available by our public health entities, be it at the state, local, or national level. At first, I think, you know, it was a learning process for everyone. This was a new, you know, a new type of virus that people were dealing with. The federal government was not doing a lot to kind of consistently track information over time. We only just started getting really detailed data about hospitalizations.
Really just now we've gotten that data.
Yeah, I mean, within the last few weeks from the federal, or month probably, with at the federal level. So that's all to say, a lot of that fell to the states to sort out. And at first, we were getting a lot of this information in kind of bits and pieces, you know, from press releases, from press conferences, things like that. Eventually, the state did, you know, start kind of putting together, here's kind of a dashboard, here's a standardized list of, you know, new cases, hospitalizations, eventually, and tragically, you know, deaths from COVID-19. But in the background, within the newsroom, I think, you know, I am a data person for our newsroom. So I'm always very interested in how can we measure things over time? How can we kind of organize all of these bits and pieces of information in a way that's meaningful both for our reporting, but also for the public? So I started cataloging, you know, those pieces of data into a spreadsheet. And we turned those into a series of charts that we updated. We've been updating on a daily basis since March. We've updated those charts a number of times along the way as the availability of new information has emerged. Also, you know, just kind of to be candid, to be realistic about our own capacity, we're a rather small newsroom. And we want to balance, you know, providing as much information as possible and as robust data as possible with our own ability to make sure that we can update that on a regular basis and make sure that it's accurate and consistent. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of the behind the scenes answer of how that came about. But we actually just rolled out a new version of our COVID data tracker. You can find that, I believe, by going to our homepage, nhpr.org, right now. And, you know, right now we're tracking the things that we've been tracking from the beginning, number of cases, number of hospitalizations. But we also, you know, are now providing, we're trying to provide more up-to-date information, for example, about outbreaks in jails, prisons, and other correctional facilities. Those have been very much at the forefront in recent weeks, and the state has been providing more up-to-date information in that area. We are also providing a up-to-date list of the outbreaks that are both active and closed in nursing homes, other long-term care facilities, mm-hmm. other congregate living settings. The state does make that information available on roughly a weekly basis, but there's no central dashboard where you can find that from the state. So we're providing that to make it more easy for people.
Super useful to find that at nhpr.org. I want to ask you a little more about the election this year, Casey, because the convergence of these two major stories is one of the biggest of the year. At what point during the pandemic, Casey, did those in charge in the state of New Hampshire say, we got to prepare for a September primary and a November general election unlike any we've ever seen?
I will say it was pretty early on that I think realization settled in. I think it was in April, so, you know, about a month into it, where we saw Secretary of State Bill Gardner and Attorney General Gordon McDonald, you know, in with the blessing of the governor, say that any person in New Hampshire who was concerned about COVID-19 would be able to cast an absentee ballot in, you know, in the elections in the fall. And they made that proclamation not knowing what the status of the pandemic would be in September for the primary, or the state primary, excuse me, and then November for the general election. But to make that happen, it was much more than a proclamation. It required a lot of hard work on the part of particularly local election officials, as well as state election officials, who held a lot of trainings, a lot of, you know, information sessions. There was a lot of kind of tinkering with various policies and procedures, because I think it's fair to say New Hampshire up until this year has really prided itself on its in-person election procedures. There's very much a kind of culture here of you go to the polls, you're engaged, you know, and you show up and cast your ballot on election day. That didn't happen for a lot of people this year, but again, I think thanks to a lot of hard work from a lot of people across the state saw record turnout. We saw, I'm just double checking the numbers here, more than 200,000 people cast absentee votes this year. That's way, way up from, you know, any prior election. The total number of in-person votes was actually down a little bit, but because so many people voted absentee, and I think also because of the high level of interest in this election overall, we saw record turnout overall.
And I imagine this is a story that you're going to follow in 2021, because the reason so many people were allowed to vote by absentee is not because the law was permanently changed, but because there is that anyone who is concerned about COVID-19 specifically was allowed to request and submit an absentee ballot. When COVID-19 is a thing of the past, and we're all looking forward to when that is true, this exemption won't apply anymore, and the state will have to decide what it wants to do with absentee balloting.
Indeed, indeed. And I won't get in the weeds here, but it is important to note that, you know, there are some changes that are I believe, set to expire at the end of 2020. So, you know, just a few weeks. So that's relevant because next year we have, or actually just in a matter of months, we have local town meetings that need to take place, local elections that need to take place. So there's already a lot of discussions, and I think a lot of interest, particularly on the part of people at the municipal level, in getting some clarity from state officials and from, you know, the legislature, if needed, about what parts of the election process that were around this fall will remain in place this spring for those procedures.
Well, Casey McDermott, what was your favorite story that you covered this year?
That's a really tough one. And it's, I mean, I should say too, you know, this was a hard year for a lot of people. So often it's, you know, I have to remind myself sometimes, not to be a downer too much, but, you know, when I'm entering in the numbers or updating our spreadsheets on a daily basis, there's a person behind every one of those numbers and every one of those statistics. And I think that's really important to not lose sight of in all of this. I you know, not too cheesy, but I'm really proud of a lot of the work that my colleagues have been doing across the newsroom to really elevate those, you know, voices of everyday people across New Hampshire, and to show, you know, in ways large and small, how their lives have changed this year. So I you know, not to dodge the question too much, but I'm really happy to be part of this team that's produced such good work across the board.
Well, hear, hear. And it's partly an unfair question, Casey, because if you had asked me the same question, I would kind of have to run through the list of stories I've done, that my colleagues have done here. I mean, there's so much good at nhpr.org archived for posterity really did resonate with me personally. So I appreciate you taking a stab at the question, even though it was slightly unfair.
No problem.
And let me ask you, too, what stories are you going to be following as we head into the new year?
Well, I think, you know, to build on what I was talking about with the elections, I am curious to see how our election policy is changed for the long term based on the changes that were put in place during the pandemic. I'm also interested, I think, you know, in taking a step back and looking at some of the other ways that, you know, the pandemic is affecting people's lives, perhaps in, you know, ways that we may have been overlooking as a newsroom before. And I will just use that as an invitation to anyone listening that if you feel like there's a story, particularly of people who I think are outside of the bubble of, you know, the state house, the political world, you know, which I've been spending a lot of time talking about in this segment. I think I'm really interested in doing a better job as a journalist and working with my colleagues to really elevate the voices and concerns of people who feel like their concerns have not been heard adequately. So people can always contact us at news@nhpr.org if they want to share a story or concern with us.
That email address, news@nhpr.org, goes to everybody in the newsroom. NHPR's Casey McDermott, thank you for coming on the show today and for all the updates you've provided on the exchange throughout 2020. We on staff here and our listeners certainly appreciate your presence.
Thanks so much, Peter.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on the exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello, and today we're taking stock of an extraordinary year. This year, schools contended with pandemic-related shutdowns and remote learning. Been quite a challenge for parents, teachers, and students alike. After a break, we'll talk about this unusual year in education with NHPR's Sarah Gibson. And tell us, what reporting on education-related issues did you appreciate most in 2020? Give us a call. Our number is 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send us an email. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. More on the biggest stories of 2020 after a break. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on the Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. Thank you so much for tuning in. This morning, we're taking a look back at the top stories of 2020. You can call this year a dumpster fire, a mess, a tragedy, a farce. Call it a year of paring down to the essentials, a year of going without, a year when people revealed their flaws and their heroism. Whatever you call 2020, it was not boring. We're going to focus on the top education stories of the year in this segment. What did you appreciate seeing in the news when it comes to schools? What story did you feel was most important? Give us a call. Our number is 1-800-892-6477. You can also email us. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. And we've got NHPR's Sarah Gibson with us. She's been covering education in New Hampshire this year. Hey, Sarah.
Hi, Peter.
So let's go way back a million years ago to January 2020. At the beginning of the year, it seemed like the big story to look forward to was school funding. Were there any big decisions made this year regarding school funding?
There were not really any big decisions. Just for context, there has been some consensus that the formula that directs state money to districts is pretty outdated. It doesn't make a ton of sense, but there's really no agreement on how to improve that formula and improve how the state funds education across the state. So the funding formula has been under scrutiny in the courts. The state Supreme Court did hear a case brought by Conval School District and a couple other districts in the southwestern corner of the state. We haven't heard back on a ruling yet, so no big decisions there. It is thought by some that that case will actually just be sent back to the lower courts, but we don't know yet. And then there was a commission to study school funding that met regularly in spite of, you know, having to do that over Zoom. And they delivered a really hefty report this fall, essentially recommending that there be an overhaul of the funding formula, that the state target its money to poorer districts to achieve better outputs, particularly among poorer students who tend to not kind of reach the average student performance for the state. But it's pretty hard to imagine any of this being a priority with budget shortfalls anticipated and just a lot of other things on lawmakers' plates in the coming months.
Okay, so clearly this is a story that's going to make headlines in 2021 as well. Best of intentions, of course, at the beginning of the year to focus on school funding. But then the pandemic hit in March. Governor Sununu ordered all school buildings to close and transition to virtual instruction. How did schools handle that sudden shift back in March?
It was a patchwork. So many were able to get up and running pretty quickly. You know, we were hearing about virtual school and workbooks getting to students within a couple days or a week. There were a lot of technological challenges. There was this era of like Zoom bombing where people would think they were having a closed Zoom class and all of a sudden, you know, they would see indecent photos or someone would pop in. And a lot of teachers just were not trained at all in how to provide live instruction and in fact didn't provide live instruction. So we heard complaints certainly from parents saying, my kid hasn't interacted with their teacher in a number of months. And then there was the question of just getting adequate technology, not just to teachers, but to students who were stuck at home. A lot of services were postponed. And it was a tough time. But I will say there was a lot of creativity. And I think there was a sense of pride in districts and by the state and how quickly that shift in the spring occurred. I don't know if people here remember, but there was this phenomenon of kind of like B-grade videos that would be posted on social media of principals who are still in, you know, the school, trying to stay connected to students, deliver daily announcements, lead, you know, a Pledge of Allegiance. We got all these videos of librarians reading aloud or, you know, elementary school teachers trying to do something really fun, and that would end up on YouTube. So there are all these virtual efforts to stay connected. And a lot of districts also did a pretty good job getting food to students, which is a big, you know, role of schools these days is feeding students. And we saw some really creative ways that everything from Wi-Fi hotspots to meals were being delivered to students in rural as well as urban areas.
I remember seeing here in Concord pickup areas where kids or families could pick up lunches to go. That was one of the things that schools did to really adapt to this strange world we were living in. And Sarah, speaking of which, the pandemic, of course, exacerbated inequalities that were already present in the education system. Your reporting initiative, COVID in the Classroom, meant to highlight some of those as well as other education issues in the state. Could you tell us more about that?
Yeah, you know, we kind of know crises tend to lay bare existing longstanding inequalities, and that certainly has been the case with pandemic education. So, you know, some believe and hope that schools are the great equalizer. I think that's debatable in some cases, but you know, when people are in the school building, there is a common set of resources and experience and that are shared in that school. If you're at home learning, your outcomes and access is largely determined by your family's resources. So we really saw that play out in the spring, and to some extent are still seeing that now. So, you know, I have heard stories of kids who are at home, their parents are essential workers, so they are not monitored or, you know, don't have someone kind of standing by them saying you have to log into Zoom. They're sharing one Chromebook that was lent by the school that doesn't do a great job logging on to Zoom to begin with. They're sharing it among a number of different siblings. Their Wi-Fi is spotty, and some of the kind of basic connections and services that they typically get in school they haven't had for months. And there's real anxiety that those kids are going to fall behind to the extent that they maybe would even need to repeat a grade. And we are seeing more failing grades, more absenteeism that districts are starting to report this fall, to some extent as a result of those inequities, but also as a result of just larger disengagement that happens if you're expected to learn from home for months on end during a pretty stressful time where, you know, your whole family might be stressed and also dealing with every anxiety imaginable from whether or not you're going to, you know, get coronavirus or be, you know, if you can stay healthy and whether or not you can get food on the table if you have lost your job. So the anxiety levels have really been high for all families, but I think particularly for those who were already facing economic and other challenges prior to the pandemic.
And New Hampshire has a sort of tradition and political culture of local control, which meant school districts had some degree of leeway when deciding whether or not to stay remote or return to in-person learning this fall. Can you talk a little bit about how those decisions were made, Sarah?
Yeah, as you said, the decisions were really left up to the school leaders and school boards with some guidance from the state. But these folks are not trained epidemiologists. And so they were trying to make decisions based on the science that we had at the time. But as you may recall, our understanding of the coronavirus and of transmission of it in August is really different than it is now, right? So, people were trying to make a decision over the course of the summer about whether or not to return in person. And there was pressure from all sides. I mean, parents were saying, we have to get back to work. We can't keep on overseeing our kids like we did in the spring. A bunch of teachers and teachers unions were really concerned that there weren't proper safety measures, they said, in the building. There was a lot of fear that kids wouldn't know how to wear masks, that like just the mask wearing policies would not work. Turns out they did, generally. But school leaders had to figure out, is our HVAC system up to date? Do I have enough teachers who are going to come into the building still? And do we have, school nurses who can be on call whenever there's a potential symptom among our student population? So they really made decisions that we're going to make some group unhappy. And we ended up seeing a patchwork where some schools stayed fully remote, others were fully in person with safety measures like distancing and mask wearing. And then a lot of others did something called a hybrid model. The idea here was to have smaller groups of students in the building at the same time to limit those class sizes and enable social distancing. So kids would basically go in to the building a couple days a week and then be learning from home for the rest of the week, though in most cases, teachers were there 5 days a week in the building.
What about outbreaks in schools? I mean, the governor just yesterday at his weekly press conference said that they've been not happening at schools. Does your reporting bear that out? Is that true?
It is largely true that we're not seeing big outbreaks associated with schools, but And that's actually something that scientists and public health experts are observing in other parts of the country as well. This has been a really evolving science and something that we've had to kind of watch play out. But there are studies now from various places and in other countries even where schools are not kind of the hot spots we expected them to be, in part because of all the safety measures that have been taken. However, it's really tricky to know exactly what's going on in schools, because while the state, says they have the data to back up that no transmission is happening in schools, their current dashboard, as I've reported, does not capture all the nuances. The state only captures the number of cases and outbreaks in a school if that school is in person. So if you go remote for 2 weeks or for a week because there's been a couple cases, a bunch of people are quarantined in your school, and people then learn that they have the coronavirus, they get tested, they're positive. If they're remote, that doesn't show up on the dashboard. Hmm. So there's a little bit of inconsistency in the data we're seeing from schools. But in general, community transmission is what's driving, driving our surge, not schools, according to the data we have and to the doctors even that I've spoken to.
So, Sarah, you mentioned earlier that, at the beginning of this, in the spring, there was a lot of creativity, like principals were doing fun things to keep kids engaged. To what extent is that still happening? Or is everybody just so exhausted by the pandemic and the extra strain it's caused that there's little mental energy left for that kind of engagement? What are you seeing?
Yeah, there is profound exhaustion and burnout from teachers, from admin, from parents, and to some extent from students. I still hear these wonderful stories of, someone who says, I know it's really cold, but my outdoor classroom is still on. And we're figuring out how to get everyone outside for a majority of the day. They just bundle up. And it's been an extraordinary kind of opportunity to learn outside, even as the weather gets cold. You know, but other places that tried to get really creative, they've actually had to go remote. So all of those efforts that teachers made to be outside a bunch of the day or to, you know, engage with their students in person, that ends when you go remote. However, there are also really cool things happening still with remote learning. You know, I certainly hear of ways that students are staying connected to their teachers and even to their counselors and social workers. But I think that kind of sense of optimism and hope and learning that was happening as people had to get used to new platforms, I think it's waning a little bit. And, you know, as we kind of enter into a long and tough winter and realize vaccines are coming, but remote learning and hybrid learning and disrupted learning is here to stay for at least a number of more months.
Well, NHPR Sarah Gibson, thank you so much for a year's worth of extraordinary education reporting. We look forward to reading your byline in 2021.
Thanks, Peter.
And that's our show for today. But remember, you can find links to stories we discussed today at nhpr.org. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio, and today's show is produced by Jane Vaughn. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our engineer is Dan Colgan. Our executive producer is Michael Brindley. Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips produced the show, and our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. I'm Peter Biello. Thank you very much for listening, and have a great weekend.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.